passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
We want a dynamite from the most wrestling site, AEW, lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly, as we hear from John and Waitin. Where we're going, we don't need roads, and if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show, and if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
It is Wednesday night. Rewind to Dynamite. John Pollock and Wei Ting are here with you. And Wei, we have talked about the idea of a three-hour AEW block. And I'm wondering if they're not even going to announce it. They're just going to quietly increase these overruns to the point that you just suddenly they're going to say, yeah, it's a three-hour show. Haven't you noticed? And they're going to just, this is like putting the frog in the boiling water.
How long was today's overrun?
I mean, I feel it was like longer than most.
Like 10 minutes, right? Something like that.
At least that. I mean, we're starting here at like 10:15, which is later than usual for us.
Yeah, like the main event ended. Like, I think the main event ended with a bit of an overrun. And then they announced that they had two more segments left after that.
With 5 minutes, well, 5 to the top of the hour, you had Excalibur stating, we still have lots to come tonight, and he's plugging. We're going to hear from Mercedes. We're going to hear from the winner, and the Young Bucks are here. I was like, how much do we have here? Now, they did end off on a pretty high note to a show that had a really interesting crowd in Edmonton. I will say that.
Interesting. Okay. I'm curious to know what you mean by interesting.
Well, you know what I mean. When you're chanting for your hockey team as a woman is disclosing like seizures that she has overcome, it's a little awkward.
It is awkward and somewhat unfortunate timing. We will talk about that segment. And, maybe it should be noted that the Edmonton Oilers are about to embark on a very important series against the Vancouver Canucks at this moment. I think we're speaking.
Don't get on my bad side. Okay. I haven't made my pick yet for the series. Okay.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Maybe they can eliminate each other. Is that possible? I guess we're guaranteed a Canadian team advances.
You really think either of them?
Let's call this the Rogers Sportsnet Cup because they're just praying to the heavens that one Canadian team makes it to the finals.
That's, I think, your next campaign to laugh at all of Canada for thinking that any of these teams have a chance.
Well, we will see. On Thursday, we're going to be releasing Rewind Away, Volume 156, the WrestleMania 30 edition. This is a really intriguing show that Wei and I are going to drop probably close to 3 hours of discussion about, surrounding the rise of Bryan Danielson, how this whole WrestleMania ended up being booked and rebooked after the departure of CM Punk. This is the first Mania on the WWE Network. It's the end of the streak that we will discuss in depth and a lot of other stuff that is going on. Surreal story involving Jim Hellwig back to the company and dies days after this event. Like, there was just so much going on, and this is sort of just this intersection point of all these different interesting news stories and the launch of Global Force Wrestling that week. So, I mean, we have so much to chat about.
Maybe we'll spend the majority of the review on the last story there.
Yes.
So much to talk about just that alone. Yeah, no, this was one that I think I'm a little surprised we haven't already covered in this iteration of the show, but it's a big one because of all the news that's attached to it. I mean, maybe some of us will remember the Daniel Bryan matches. I'm sure everybody remembers the Undertaker match, but all of that is to say, like, this seems to be one of the more well-remembered WrestleManias. Is it well-remembered for the in-ring quality, or is it more so because of the news where the events attached to it? We'll discuss.
Yes, and it was still on regular pay-per-view, and it actually did a very good number. Probably 95% wrestling fans, 5% thinking this was a porn parody.
There's that too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's coming out on Thursday on Rewind Away. Also on Thursday, folks, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, it's a special Thursday edition of Pollock and Thurston because TKO was holding their earnings call tonight, and we are going to have our reaction and breakdown of that. We're also going to be joined by Lucas Sharpio, who was the reporter that was at the Backlash press conference that asked the question about the exit of Drew Gulak from the company and a follow-up about whether Ronda Rousey and her accusation had anything to do with it. And of course, there was a whole storm that came out of this question. So he will be on with us to chat about that experience and his own just experience of covering Backlash France and everything surrounding that. So that is coming up on a special Thursday edition of Pollock and Thurston. And then Way and I are back Friday night with Rewind to SmackDown on the Cafe. We will have a SmackDown review and taking your calls where Way, we are getting an 8-person king and queen of the ring bracket as well on the SmackDown side.
But we're not getting all of those matches on SmackDown. We can't.
Well, they put out the bracket. I don't think they have promoted them all for SmackDown, but I guess they're going to they have to do all these matches in some point. They can't throw all of these on the house shows.
I mean, not all of them, but I imagine a section of them, I have to think.
I guess some of them. It's a lot of effort for these house shows. But yes, this is this will be another interesting, SmackDown, man, there's most weeks they get four matches in. Yeah. So we'll see how this is booked. Maybe we'll get some quick matches, but I guess notable, Tama Tonga is going to be in a match taking on Bobby Lashley. Then we got Santos Escobar and LA Knight, Carmelo Hayes against Baron Corbin, and then the top of the bracket, AJ Styles and Randy Orton, that I would assume will be reserved for television.
Maybe you would think so. Do we have the women's side of the brackets yet?
So I don't know if they've announced the participants, but it is a same number as the Raw side, but I don't know if they have revealed those names yet. So anyway, yeah, that's all coming up later on this week.
Okay.
So I will spend most of the time going through the TKO stuff on Thursday with Brandon, but just some keynotes coming out of it. The most noteworthy thing is that they did announce a short-term extension of Raw on the USA Network for the fourth quarter of the year, where Raw did not have a home for these final 3 months of the year. The current deal with NBC Universal expires September 30th. So they have agreed to a 3-month extension for $25 million, which, based on the average annual value of this existing deal, NBC Universal is saving $40 million of what these 3 months are worth. So to me, it's a steal for NBC Universal to have, what is going to be during football season. So this is not going to be the number one program on cable Monday nights, but it's still going to perform very well. And I am curious if this kind of hometown discount for a broadcaster that you are staying in business with through SmackDown and, of course, through Peacock, I wonder if this will give an allowance that they can actively promote Raw moving to Netflix as maybe something they've carved out for themselves that, hey, we're giving you this great deal. But it also makes you wonder, how were there any other interested parties to take a lame duck show for 3 months that you're not building your programming around? It would just be for 3 months, because I just see these 3 months of programming are worth a whole lot more than $25 million given the current economy.
Sure, absolutely. Although, if you're the WWE, this is probably the best case scenario, other than maybe an earlier move to Netflix. But maybe
you do not want to promote another place to send your audience to and exactly. Then have to do that again in 3 months for Netflix.
For 3 months, exactly. So I think the leverage was, in this case, probably on USA side, and you judge, by the value that they seem to gain from out of this deal. It probably was up to their own negotiation about whether or not they wanted to accept and for what price. So even if a more lucrative offer might have appeared for the WWE, this is probably still their preferred option, I have to think.
They reported net revenues between the UFC and WWE of $629.7 million, but a net loss for the quarter of $249.5 million, a huge expense was for the UFC antitrust settlement, which they announced are going to be split into three payouts, with the first one being $100 million this quarter, another $100 million in the fourth quarter of 2024, and then the final sum of $135 million in the second quarter of next year. And they pretty much stated on the call that this settlement is not going to affect the way they do business, because there had been the question of were there other details that they negotiated, such as any changes to contracts or any of that. It sounds like this is pure cash that they are spending with a $335 million settlement for the two antitrust suits that were filed. And it's a big weight off the shoulder of TKO for their investors, that this was of a concern of, if this went to court, of what the fee could be. $335 million, not anything to sneeze at, but a very manageable figure for this company overall. But that was a key reason of a big expense that they had. And beyond that, they mentioned the fact that WrestleMania in Vegas, it's tied to both cash and non-cash incentives. So probably getting a nice amount and maybe some,
tax breaks, whatever, like things like that.
I was going to say maybe like free chips for the table, unlimited drinks, you know, that kind of thing.
What's the value of the drinks, I wonder?
In Vegas, that can go for a premium. And UFC's domestic television rights, the negotiating window, will begin in January. So we're still quite a ways away before UFC can take in outside offers. They've already mentioned that there are multiple parties interested, and those are going to be significant rights. But it is so hard to predict where the television landscape will be in 6 months when they're looking here. But they seem to be in pretty good shape. And one of the theories I've heard thrown out there is the idea, if Warner Brothers Discovery loses the NBA, do they make a play for the UFC? Like, there is all these options that are out there.
That would be interesting. And let's say AEW stays on Warner.
Very possible. Very possible. And I mean, would Max be a place that they would want to house these pay-per-views? You lose the NBA and it's a big hit to your profile and potentially your carriage fees, but you have all this money that you are saving as a result of it that you could bid really high for something like the UFC rights. There's the Netflix component with the UFC. Like, there's all these options that it's very hard to predict, but I think the UFC, like, you just look, the NBA is about to jump to something like $7 billion a year they're going to get in these next rounds of negotiations. And the UFC is not the NBA, but the UFC is, I think they're poised for something very strong. I would be most confident of them, of AEW, WWE, and UFC. I think the UFC is best positioned, but we will see what happens there. Moving on, we have some news from Saudi Arabia. There was an announcement by Turki Alaşık, who is the chairman of the board of directors of the General Entertainment Authority. They announced an extension of their partnership with the UFC. So they are holding an event in Saudi Arabia on June 22nd. They're also going to add another event either late this year or early next year as part of Riyadh season. They're also going to sponsor UFC 306, which is the event at the Sphere in Las Vegas, September 14th. And most of all, breaking barriers, Riyadh is going to host its first Power Slap event as part of this extended deal. So it's time to export Power Slap to Saudi Arabia.
Sorry, it's an extended deal, announced with the UFC deal at the same time?
Yes.
So Power Slap does have a relationship with the UFC?
I mean,
obviously, other than Dana, but like in an official capacity, do they have?
It's one of those deals. It's kind of like the XFL when this latest iteration that Vince McMahon was running, where, I mean, the UFC uses a lot of their socials to promote Power Slap. It's like you are benefiting greatly from the UFC machine.
I see.
But it is technically, a Dana White, Lorenzo Fertitta, those are the key investors in it. But yeah, it was included here in this announcement. And then while speaking to ESPN, Alaşık mentioned that there's going to be an enhancement to the deal with WWE that will be signed in June. Now, I translate enhancement to mean money. That is my interpretation of enhancement. And they are
money in exchange for more value, you would think as well.
I think so. And he spoke about the fact of wanting to bring big wrestling events to the country, specifically mentioning the potential of a WrestleMania or a Royal Rumble. And I think you and I have spoken about this, like the idea of a WrestleMania in Saudi Arabia, not surprising at all that that is what they are aiming for, because I think number one, you are looking at both promoting this country as a tourist destination and a place where Americans feel, or Canadians, what have you, are feel safe traveling to Saudi Arabia, and this becomes a destination for tourists. And I think they're going to be looking at big time events like that. They're trying it with boxing. They are bringing big concerts, but something like a WrestleMania, that would be the goal. It's not so much of an idea of just servicing your audience that's already getting two big WWE shows a year, but it's also bringing people over there and talking about how great of a place this is to travel to.
Even maybe taking away, you know, in-person tourism, just the media attention itself and just the conversation around WrestleMania taking place this year in Saudi Arabia, and just maybe the continued normalization of, you know, Saudi Arabia being a destination not dissimilar to Lyon, or how we think of really kind of like, you know, any other destination free of human rights issues around the world.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So it's like, if you're planning a vacation, maybe Power Slap is going to be the event that brings you over to Saudi Arabia. And if not, they'll try WrestleMania.
Maybe they'll bundle it with a WrestleMania weekend.
That could always be, you know, a Power Slap crossover at a WrestleMania. All potential.
Yeah. Hall of Fame / Power Slap /
Minoru Suzuki comes in for Power Slap, the celebrity edition. Yeah.
Right.
So all potential. The key is, what does this, you know, extension or change of the deal mean financially for them? Like, they're taking in roughly $50 million per event. And also, it was noted on the call. Here, I'll read this. This was from Brandon Ross at Lightshed Partners, noting the fact that investors feared existential risk to UFC when the Saudi investment into PFL, you'll remember, was announced last summer, and how Liv had really upended the PGA with all of the money. And this took a big hit on the TKO stock price. And he goes on to state that, additionally, investors feared the Saudi relationship was the one thing that TKO could not replace with Vince McMahon's departure. And the fact that the UFC is now so deeply involved with Saudi Arabia, this has largely, it says, it is clear the Saudis just wanted to be more relevant in MMA and are getting there in real time with the UFC, and essentially stating that the PFL, they did not capitalize on this at all, and the UFC has kind of taken over this part of the world. But also from the wrestling side, like, that was, for whatever you want to say, like, Vince McMahon was the one that spearheaded this, had the relationship with the Saudis, and helped put that UFC deal in play as well. And on the call, they stated, like, Nick Khan is the one that has kind of inherited this relationship now. He is the one leading all of this. But it was interesting to note, like, that was something that was a specialty attached to Vince McMahon that they felt was obviously, like, he was the guy that was leading that.
Like, and I'm so curious what that would entail. Does he just have, you know, MBS on speed dial? Does he just, like, text, which would be a very scary exchange to envision with the guy all the time? I mean, this that comes
I don't know if Vince is allowed to text anymore.
That comes as no real surprise. You know, like, we know Saudi Arabia just simply wants the platform, so to speak, and WWE really wants the money. Like, you know, we might have speculated at the end of this these 10 years whether or not this deal would continue, but what were we thinking? Of course it's going to continue. You know, we're talking about the WWE now that is probably more reliant on this than ever when it comes to their stockholder share prices and just the future prospects. I mean, they've grown accustomed to receiving this enormous amount of money every year.
Yeah, it's not at all surprising on that front. And you could, as I've mentioned, like, you can put your kind of, like, moral opinion of this aside from the fact that to walk away from this is, you know, you're there to deliver this value to your shareholders that this represents. I will say it is amazing to look at the change in Ari Emanuel from his reaction as one of the few when the Jamal Khashoggi murder occurred and turning away investment, and how he has he went into a period of where it was almost like indifference. He was not going to speak negatively about it, but he was also not going to be championing the cause. And now it's like, you could not be more deep into this now. Like, this is one of the leading entertainment properties between UFC and WWE that is going to be sending over regular events and only deepening its commitment to.
Well, it's a reminder that he too has masters to serve, and that is the share price. It's you know, I'm sure his entire company. I think it also says a lot about just public sort of like relaxing of concerns. Obviously, they were probably the biggest when, you know, the Khashoggi murder took place. And now I just sense a more general acceptance and general apathy that this is sort of like the reality of all of our entertainment properties.
You will never sit down and listen to this interview. Bill Maher did a 90-minute show with Dana White. I have not listened to all of it, but there is a discussion. I don't know why I'm just moving over here to this now, but it comes to mind. And Bill Maher is trying to get – they're talking about like – men talking about their feelings.
Okay.
To Dana White's response, I don't want to talk about my fucking feelings. And Bill Maher is like, you don't mean that. Like, even in this discussion, you've shared like some of your feelings. He's like, no, I'm that guy that doesn't want to talk about any of this stuff. You sound like my wife. And he talks about, I see these guys on social media. Oh, I had a bad day. Shut the fuck up. Go to work. I don't care about
go
my
go to work, blast Kid Rock.
He's, you know, like, I don't care about my fucking feelings. And yeah. It was like, you could like just ask like ChatGPT, construct a response to Dana White about men prioritizing mental health. You could not come up with a greater parody than
who
the real
needs
thing.
That? I'm just gonna shoot my gun. You know, that's why would I need therapy?
It's just a classic answer. I howled. It was so funny. A man who was not howling over the past couple of days was Ric Flair. So, fresh off the disclosure of his potential heart attack he had in his last match, he went over pizza on the weekend. What could go wrong? Okay, he went to a family event. There was a graduation at the University of Florida, and then they decided, you want to go for Chinese? Should we go for pizza? Let's go for pizza. So they went to Paisano's Stone Fired Pizza, and what happened is, I'm still trying to piece it together, Way. I'll try and do my best here. So there was a kitchen staff member that I guess was using the bathroom, and okay. Rick was not happy with the amount of time this person was taking in the bathroom. Flair goes in and I guess sees the person through the stall texting away, and he is accused by one of the female staff of being a peeping Tom and a creep, and he was offended by this. And he admitted he got very upset and decided to do what any person in this situation would do. I'm going to tweet about my experience at this restaurant. Always a great move if you're a celebrity. He says, he tweeted, I spent $1,500 at Paisano's Stone Fired Pizza, which he added, to be disrespected more than I ever have in my entire life. More than he's been disrespected in his entire life. And he was booked consistently in 2000 in WCW. After taking 20 pictures with customers and staff, I was asked to leave because of an issue I had with the kitchen manager taking too long in the bathroom. I would highly recommend that anyone who wants to enjoy a relaxing time in Gainesville at a nice restaurant to never visit this place. Woo. Number one, I have many questions here. Number one, we have to get to the bottom of this capitalizing every word in his tweets.
Mm-hmm.
Do you physically have to do this? Like, it can't be manual, right? It's got to be an automatic, some function that he has turned on that just does this. Because there's no way. This would be a 30-minute tweet.
I can't imagine Ric Flair, like, hitting the shift for every single word in his tweets. I also don't know what setting would create this function in a phone. To my knowledge, at least on iPhones, there's no like sentence case every word, checkbox that you can enter. Beyond that,
how does he not have at Ric Flair? That's my other question.
Well, maybe he preferred Ric Flair at
Natter Boy
without the anyway. This has also been years, and it's not like he doesn't have people around him that understand technology. You know, we know Conrad is very good with technology. How is this like still on at this point? It's almost just a gimmick. You know,
it's kind of his thing. So he tweeted this, and then Paisano's. I can't believe this is what we're recapping. The Paisano's Pizza co-owner went to the newspaper. Jerry Roberts spoke to the Gainesville Sun. We've reviewed video of the incident that took place recently at our restaurant. It's clear our team worked in a professional manner to ensure the safety of guests and staff. We've thanked our team for their professionalism. We're proud of how they responded to this situation, using and displaying our team values. So then the video released, okay? And this wasn't even on Dynamite. And we got the 2.5 minute some of this security footage the blocking is just pristine. It's just in the perfect.
I don't
place.
Know if it's security footage. I think this was somebody their cell phone out. Yeah,
I guess this was someone at the bar or something. But like a perfect shot and and subtitled for everyone's help. And like Flair's just cutting
very inaccurately through AI.
What I did pick up was him calling him, what's your name? Nicholas. Nicholas Dickhead. And then he offered the woman $1,000 tip for you to tell him to kiss my ass. Rick was in full promo mode here. And then one of the gentlemen here to his right offered to go fight him outside. I mean, this was...
Flair's last match.
Folks, this was a celebratory meal after a graduation. Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make fun, but this is ridiculous, okay? This is just a ridiculous story. And it ends with Ric Flair being called up on the MJ Morning Show in Tampa today. And at least the man seems a bit more level-headed. He said, it just escalated. I was wrong for getting mad, but I kind of felt like I was defending my position. I was wrong for losing my temper when I feel like I'm put in that area where I'm uncomfortable. And all of a sudden, everything just fell apart. I got upset. And then he said, I was wrong for getting upset. I probably should have just walked out the door. But it caught me so off guard because we were having a wonderful time. And then someone in the kitchen said that I did something wrong in the bathroom and there's no one there except me and him. So this was also him also being much more calmer because he too was he was contacted by the Gainesville Sun stating he was considering legal action and that I have the money to buy the restaurant. It'll be called Ric Flair's Italian Bistro. So he was threatening to buy this restaurant. That's not a great Sunday. That is my conclusion.
I guess in the life of the Nature Boy, maybe it's kind of typical at this point. I'm amazed at how much this man continues to be in the news cycle, especially in the past week, you know, between this and the heart attack story and informing the world how much he made off of that Migos song.
Yes.
I mean, for a guy who, you know, is no longer an active wrestler, not even on TV, as far as we know, on AEW, hasn't appeared since the Sting match.
Got pissed off that he wasn't interviewed for the Death of WCW documentary.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Well, he certainly is opinionated. We might be kind of kidding about this, but this was kind of sad, man. You know, like to see Flair in this state and knowing, I think, the stories that might continue to be out there about Rick, it's like...
He does deny that he's denying that he was drunk, but he did not deny that he had some drinks before this. So we will put that out there.
Yeah. Well, strictly, I don't know exactly what happened in the bathroom with this gentleman, nor whatever preceded this event. But just watching the clip itself that's been circulating, I don't think Rick looks good at all in it. He looks like the one who's clearly tense and the one who's calling names, calling the people behind the bar dipshit and dickhead and all these names, while the people who are operating this restaurant are just there to try to de-escalate and to try to get this person out of their restaurant. It's a bad look for him. I don't know if this becomes anything other than just, you know, maybe at this point headlines, but I don't know. I just think it's kind of sad to see.
Do you how do you feel this has, like, AEW's relationship with Ric Flair. It's a loose one, but it's a relationship nonetheless. And you could certainly look at that. We don't know what the value of this deal is. We know that it's pretty much paying for Rick's what appearances they were. And it does not feel like he's going to be any kind of presence on camera moving forward unless they had some cameo reason for it. But I don't think the association has done them wonders either.
I don't think so either.
For either side, to be quite honest.
Even for the Sting component of the deal, it made perfect sense, I'm sure, at the time. Hey, we have a chance to get Ric Flair essentially for free to help us tell a story with Sting's retirement. Made all the sense in the world. You know, we're going to Charlotte for the last match. Whether due to audience backlash or whatever reason, they didn't even capitalize on that. And it really didn't make any difference, in my opinion, to the story of Sting's retirement. You can argue they didn't capitalize even on Sting's retirement enough, you know, in the build up to the actual match. But at this point, I don't know if, like, I think we would have seen Flair on TV by now. They still promote Woo Energy, as far as I can recall.
Yep.
So the story still, the deal's still active, but they're not using Flair at all. And I don't know if that's just due to not having story or public dissatisfaction to seeing him. But I can't really say, like, AEW needs a Ric Flair right now.
Other notes, Raw on Monday doing 1,619,000 viewers and a 0.53 in the demo, both down 4% from the previous week, which was the draft show. This was going against the Pacers-Knicks that did over 4.2 million viewers, and the third hour went against the Timberwolves-Nuggets game. They were also up against the Boston Bruins and Florida Panthers, 1,847,000 viewers. The Bruins might be the top drawing hockey team at the moment, and I'm not even exaggerating. I think this series is picking up. So, I mean, they got something out of beating the Leafs.
Look at that smile on your face.
I'm just stating a fact here, okay? Their numbers are very impressive. NXT doing 659,000 viewers and a 0.19 in the demo. This was way up from last week's Spring Break-In episode, up 17% in viewers, up 36% in the demo. And for total viewership, it was their second highest number since January. So kind of surprising, because last week was all built around, you know, this Spring Break-In, the second part of it. And this week it was sort of... you know, it didn't have anything gigantic attached to it. You could argue, like, the Roxanne Perez-Chelsea Green match was the main event that they did promote, but they did do well. And the final thing is the season finale way of Dark Side of the Ring, Black Saturday, The Rise of Vince McMahon, that aired on Tuesday night. And it was a pretty informative hour, especially if you didn't know all of the details. There were some interesting people that were interviewed, the key ones being Jim Cornette as the resident historian. And then specific to this story, they had your favorite Tommy Rich, who, I mean, a staple of Georgia Championship Wrestling. Can't say he added a whole lot to this episode. Bob Roop, who looked shockingly like Ole Anderson near the end before Ole died. Like, it was uncanny how similar they look. Jerry Briscoe, who was one of the key shareholders that sold to Vince McMahon. Nick Patrick was interviewed for this. And then they tracked down two former Georgia Championship Wrestling employees in Bobby Simmons and Luis Cochran, as well as Ole's son, Bryant Rogowski, who was very good. And I mean, you did not even need to caption this guy. You could tell he was the son of Ole Anderson. He was very well spoken. And I thought he was a great stand-in, because, I mean, Ole only died in February, but he was in no shape or condition to do any kind of sit down interview by those latter stages of his life.
Yeah, I believe it was mentioned by his son that like, at the time of filming, Ole was alive, but in no condition due to MS.
And Dave Meltzer was also interviewed for the piece, and they kind of just explained, like, there was a lot that they had to convey, especially for a wrestling audience that maybe did not know the exact setup of the Georgia wrestling territory and getting onto the Superstation, and therefore why it was such a powerful station to be on in the U.S. and kind of Vince McMahon's rise to power, buying the company from his father in 1982. And I would say the main character of this, like, aside from Vince McMahon, is Jim Barnett. And unfortunately, Jim Barnett, he died 20 years ago. just would have been such a great figure if he had ever done a book or some extended interviews. I mean, he's just someone that comes up that you would think we've only scratched the surface of really understanding just the influence that he had. And he was pretty much like the mechanic here that was putting together a lot of these deals behind the scenes. And he's involved with Georgia Championship Wrestling, and he's kind of ousted when Ole kind of looks at the books and this guy is skimming all of this money to keep up his appearance and this lifestyle and taking it out of the company. So Ole pretty much just throws him out of the company, and he's not willing to keep him on and even give him a title. And so Barnett is like, okay, cool. And he called up Vince McMahon, and I mean, this is a very dangerous guy to be sending to the competition when this guy knows how your business is run, probably is aware of a lot of contracts that and deals that he negotiated. So, I mean, it was almost like you were like this guy was like the poison pill of this wrestling war. And he is able to
a lethal dose of poison.
That was it. Maybe it was Vince McMahon living out his Jim Barnett relationship when he brought the NWO back. And yeah, so Barnett orchestrates a meeting with the Briscoes, who they're getting frustrated because as shareholders, they think they should be making more. They think they should be expanding more. And Ole is trying to explain to them that like he's paying out what he can. And Ole kind of gets the Briscoes tell him that they feel that they want to get Ole out of this position. And they end up coming to an agreement and take a blood oath together, never to screw each other, which way you and I have never taken a blood oath. But if we do, I'm not going to take a chunk out of my forehead as this was depicted. This was one of the more wild reenactments that I'm sure there was a blood oath. I doubt it was as graphic as they made it here, but subtlety has no place in right. These recreations.
I think blood oaths make for a great story. Unfortunately, I don't know if they're very enforceable in court.
You don't know until you try, but I would argue that. And the fact that Ole did not prevail in court probably proves your point. But in 83, your shareholders were Ole Anderson, the Briscoes, Fred Ward, Ralph Freed, Jerry Oates, and Paul Jones.
And it looks like from this reenactment photo, Jimmy Corderas.
Jimmy Corderas, he quietly had the key percentage of shareholder votes that was really going to screw Ole.
Good for Jimmy.
The real underhanded shark.
Who did he play? Any idea?
I don't know who he was necessarily depicting. Maybe he was Jerry Oates.
I have no idea who, I guess, anybody else would look like, but all right.
Well, anyway, so Ole has written about this extensively in his book, and he believed there was no way he could ever get overthrown and blindsided, because in the shareholder agreement, it was that if any shareholders were to sell, they would have to offer them to the other shareholders first before they went outside. But then there was a part in the shareholders agreement that they could essentially like waive this. And Ole claims like he went to the people in the company and they assured him this was not any kind of loophole, that he would be protected by this. Turns out he was not. And he's completely blindsided by this as Vince McMahon gets the controlling.
I use my blood. We had a blood oath.
His blood did not hold up in court as Vince got 67.5% of the company. And this was actually finalized earlier in the year, but Ole takes them to court, and that's why they don't get on the air until July 14th of that year. And this is where Ole explains, like, he's blindsided. Well, his family is explaining that his mother had died right around this time, so he's dealing with all of this. And Ole meets with Vince, and Vince is at least cordial with Ole and introduces him to his wife, Linda. And this is a story that I assume happened because of it being Ole Anderson. This is one that you could easily believe that maybe this is a bit of a legend. But as the story goes, when he was introduced to Linda, Ole's response, which they gave to Jim Cornette to recite, "Fuck you and fuck Linda." And that was the belief of, like, Vince McMahon was never going to do business with this guy. And over the years, I mean, kept that up when they finally put out like a Horseman DVD. They never interviewed Ole for it. When they put the Horseman in the Hall of Fame, they didn't invite Ole. You know, he was mentioned.
So he wasn't even invited. It wasn't Ole's choice. It was a Vince McMahon choice.
My understanding is that he wasn't even reached out to. Hmm. So, I mean, he was somebody that, like, just never worked with Vince and probably wasn't going to anyway. And, yeah, they get onto WTBS, and this is in July of 1984. So, like, WWF is on, they're on a major network in New York. They're on TBS. They're on MTV at this point. This is just a few weeks before the first MTV special in July of 84. So this is like a ton of muscle that they have all in advance of that first WrestleMania in early 1985. And as the story goes, is that there were people that called the Superstation. Newspapers at the time listed numbers like 83 people, like, picked up their phone and called asking, where the hell is our Georgia Championship Wrestling? Where the fuck is Freddie? Where is Gordon Solie?
So
not Freddie Miller.
I'm sure at the time 83 was a lot, but these days in the social media age, like, 83 is such a small number compared to, like, the amount of tweets that something like that, like this, would have, I'm sure, garnered if social media was around.
Could you imagine Ole on Twitter just monitoring the hashtag? Where's my GCW?
Would it be sentence casing or all caps?
I feel Ole would definitely have his style. I think he would definitely be an egg on Twitter. I don't know if he would ever figure out, like, the profile photo.
Right.
So maybe he'd be a TikTok guy. But yeah, the David Bixenspan has done extensive research onto, like, the ratings at this point in time and how well McMahon's television did in comparison. But one of the things Vince did not get was an exclusivity on WTBS, because Ted Turner was able to turn around and give Ole a Saturday morning slot right afterwards. So you literally had championship wrestling from Georgia taking place at the Techwood studio. And Vince McMahon, he was not doing a whole lot of original production out of the studio, which is what they wanted. And then they made a deal with Bill Watts, and he was going to come on the network as well. And then the sale is made in the following year for $1 million that Jim Crockett Jr. bought the slot. And Vince does make a profit off of this slot. And for that period of time, he was on WTBS. So it's a really fascinating story. I think Jim Cornette summarizes it really well. This was not like some seismic event that changed the course of history, but it was the canary in the coal mine. Like, this was a sign of where things were going, the power that Vince McMahon had, and that was going to be realized in the coming years. But if nothing else, everyone knew what the score was by the end of 1984 of what Vince McMahon's ultimate goals were from a national standpoint and going into other territories and paying for TV if he needed to and signing up the big stars of other territories. And he'd have some parts of the country he'd be successful in, and he had others that he was not as successful in as well. And this was sort of like a mixture of one where he pulled off a great coup to get this time slot, but ultimately it was only like a 9-month experiment that he did make money on at the end of it.
It's, I think, a story that, at least in its earliest stages, gives you an indication of how ruthless of a businessman Vince McMahon was. And I think how much of a risk taker Vince McMahon was in many ways. And I think it gave you a sense of, like, why this guy was the one to be so successful out of everybody. I think most notable for me watching the episode was the last portion of it, where they actually gave you sort of like, where are they now? With Vince McMahon fully up to date with everything to do with his dismissal from the WWE.
It was jarring. If you were somebody, I imagine the percentage of people watching this that are not wrestling fans, that are casually know Vince McMahon, I mean, this wouldn't be earth-shattering, this news. But yeah, they just kind of update on everything involving the Janelle Grant lawsuit, how he had to resign from the WWE, the update on Ole Anderson passing away in February. And yeah, kind of just like, here was this guy who was like the most powerful figure in pro wrestling, and he's resigned in disgrace. And that's sort of where he is at this time. And pending how this lawsuit turns out for him. I mean, this is a guy that has like this remarkable legacy, but one that is so stained from the personal indiscretions.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about Dark Side of the Ring, I mean, Vince is sort of like, I don't want to trivialize it, but like he kind of is like this, like the Thanos of like the entire series. Like he comes up so often as like the culprit for so many of these terrible things that have happened within the industry. So it's for this season finale to kind of end with that scene of like, this is like sort of like what's being presented as a final chapter of Vince McMahon's career. I felt kind of significant.
Yeah, I thought this was a really good season of Dark Side of the Ring. I thought they had some really strong episodes, in particular the last half of Chris Adams, Chris Colt. Even the Sandman one was pretty interesting as well. And Black Saturday was the most interesting one. I can't say like it was a lot of interesting people to hear from. I wouldn't say there were like enormous facts that were uncovered that you didn't already know, but to actually... Honestly, my biggest takeaway is just how much more I would love to see like a real big look at Jim Barnett. I think that he's just such an interesting behind the scenes power player that, you know, unfortunately, there was he was attending several of those Apocalypse wrestling shows at Cactus Pete's of all places. And I remember going to an indie show there and I watched the show and the next day I'm online. And they had like this newsletter for the Apocalypse Wrestling Federation. And yes, I subscribed to it. And they put out a picture of there's Jim Barnett sitting by the bar. And I was like, I was there in this bar. And Jim Barnett was like 20 feet away from me watching this show for the whole time. And I had no clue until the next day.
What, did you even know what he looked like at the time?
I had definitely seen pictures of him before, but not... Like would not have recognized him. Like it would, this is what we're talking like maybe 2000, 2001, very early. But nonetheless, wow. So now, you know, a lot of people in a way that were turning on, WTBS back in July of 1984, they dubbed it Black Saturday. And thankfully due to the, advancements in technology, no one has to have a Black Saturday or any day of the week and be shut out. And why?
You know a lot of reasons by now why we love using NordVPN. It allows us access to geo-block services like AEW+. It helps us unlock cheaper prices for pay-per-views. But let's not forget a VPN's most important function, protecting your online privacy. If you do any sort of downloading of content, or if you regularly use Wi-Fi outside of your home, a trusted VPN helps mask your IP to protect your browsing from advertisers, hackers, and even your ISP. And while yes, the protection of a VPN may come with slower browsing speeds, NordVPN happens to be the fastest in the game. Named CNET's fastest VPN of 2024 through their extensive speed tests, Nord clocks an average download speed loss of just 11.1%, compared to Surfshark's 17% and ExpressVPN's 24.8%. Get the protection you need from the most reputable and fastest VPN on the market for just $3 a month. Sign up through nordvpn.com/postwrestling, where listeners can get 4 bonus months on top of all 2-year plans, plus a 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, nordvpn.com/postwrestling. Get your bonus months and let them know you found Nord through us. Masterful. You've really nailed that one.
You know what? Imagine Georgia Championship Wrestling presented by NordVPN.
I think Black Saturday would have been completely avoided. You know, if everybody had their VPNs, it doesn't matter who takes over the time slot.
Oli would have got a slot on Triller TV. They would have been fine. But tonight we are going to Rogers Place in Edmonton, Alberta. I'm really glad that this telecom gets some publicity through naming rights of an arena.
So they've got a place, they've got a center, they've got what else?
An arena.
How many?
Yeah,
others?
We're going from Rogers Place to I think Rogers Arena on Saturday for the Vancouver show.
Right. All right.
It's just,
and then I'm sure at some point we'll visit Rogers Coliseum, the Rogers, embassy, whatever.
When it comes to corporate names, we are a very unimaginative country. I think that's fair to say.
I mean, when it's controlled by like one to two major telecoms, I mean, it's kind of unimaginative as it gets. We actually went to school at the Ted Rogers Communication Center. That was the name of the building.
The Rogers Communication Center.
Okay, whatever. Yes.
It was the Ted Rogers. There was something named after Ted Rogers, too. Yeah. Maybe a room or something.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
WrestleTix reporting just over 4,000 people with tickets distributed. And we kick off with Arcady Ora, who's one of the new interviewers, interviewing Adam Copeland, who's arriving. And it's like, how are you doing after the match with Buddy Matthews? And he's like, not too great. His mind is wandering into places he doesn't want, and he's going to stop it all tonight. He's been talking to Tony Khan, and tonight will be a no DQ match between him and Brody King.
Yeah, well, does he unleash the monster? Is this all part of Malakai's plan?
This had a very John Cena, Bray Wyatt tinge to it.
Mm, kind of like WrestleMania 30, yes.
It was very much like that. Orange Cassidy and Trent Barretta open things up. Trent has Chuck's name written on his wrist tape, and we got an update way. Excalibur alerts us that Chuck Taylor suffered an osteochondritis lesion of the ankle with segments of the bone underneath the cartilage that have fractured off and die within the joint. I don't know what that means, but it does not sound pleasant.
No, that sounds incredibly graphic and specific to the point where I'm wondering if there's legitimacy to it. So I can't see them mentioning Chuck this much. And first of all, him wrestling that match period and not him not actually coming back. But they're definitely trying to sell that this is a career-ending thing.
Rather than this running knee that they still don't have a name for Trent's finisher, I think he should be doing an ankle lock, and it should be called osteochondritis.
I would hate to type that every single week, but it sounds pretty badass.
I had to copy and paste it into my notes. It was it's really long. So they did mention that he will need surgery, and it could be career-ending, is what Excalibur said. So there's some hope. And we also got way the countdown clock. We're counting down to the face-to-face between Swerve and Christian Cage. And this was present throughout the first hour.
Cool. Gives us something to look forward to. I guess I don't know if it's like the type of segment that I'm anticipating so much that I need to stick around. I need to count the time to see this Christian Swerve face to face.
Way face to face is coming up. Two minute warning.
I'm sorry. I gotta go. I gotta catch.
Gotta
this.
Watch a face.
I gotta get home to watch this face to face. Like, it's not that type of segment, but I like that they're doing it to push Swerve like he's a big deal.
So they fought into the stands. They come back. Trent is going after the neck of Orange Cassidy. And they note that Tony Khan is working remotely from Jacksonville. So, like, I'm left to believe Tony's running the show remotely. But is no one answering his, like, messages? Because the Bucks are in charge on the ground in Edmonton. So who does control this show is my question.
They all do. They all have some control. Well, Kenny, even from the hospital bed, can make matches. Tony, I think, at least has the right to grant possible title matches. But when you're talking about...
But
like,
so can the Bucks, we learned.
Well, everybody. Yeah. Everybody has that power. There are a lot of matches that need to be booked. And everybody, I guess, gets a few.
Don Callis comes out. And there were a lot of boos for him. And they start chanting asshole as Shivani says, hey, they're chanting for you, Don. And Callis explains...
And he replaces Taz throughout the entire show.
That's right. Taz is off the show tonight. He explained due to his knee problems, he could not travel this week, but he said he is going to be back next week, as will Hook.
Mm.
So you're missing Edmonton and making it to Everett, Washington.
I mean, not to cross the border, I think, is some incentive. Yeah.
Callis is a big fan of Orange pushing merchandise, but he needs a change. And there's a pile driver by Trent, but he doesn't go for the cover, hits a second one, and then the running knee. And Trent removes the turnbuckle pad, and Paul Turner goes over to admonish him, allowing Orange Cassidy to remove the opposite turnbuckle pad. And Trent runs into the exposed buckle and is rolled up by Orange in 13 minutes and 17 seconds. So Cassidy wins and is immediately taken out by Trent on the floor. He goes for the eye and hits a pile driver on top of the stairs, catapults Cassidy into the bottom frame of the ring, and then grabs a toolbox. But Cassidy grabs a chair as Callis gets in between them. Chris Statlander is out, and Callis tends to Cassidy and leaves with him. So after all this to Orange Cassidy, the man left on his own power afterwards. I just wonder, like, what was the purpose of this post-match, like, injury attack?
Well, he is really, it does really hurt, you know, despite being able to walk on his legs. Like, he's still suffering the effects of a pile driver onto steel steps. He's just a really tough guy. You know, but nonetheless, I think any hope that this relationship can be patched up is completely gone. This is, you know, they had their match, yet this relationship is more strained than ever. And maybe, I think it was at least to show that. And more importantly, to give Trent his heat back after losing here to Orange Cassidy. I thought it was like a good match, you know, as you would expect from these two with their chemistry. Like it was a very physical and violent match, also as you would expect from these two. They gave Orange the win, but they're keeping Trent like alive and relevant in story. Like he's still this fully engaged in a feud with this post-match attack. I'm also very intrigued to see how Callis figures in, because it's hard for me to figure out at the moment. They're teasing Callis very much still wanting to make Orange Cassidy a member of the family. I believe his line was, it's great to have best friends, but it's better to have family, which I think is a really good line. So I'm very curious to see where it all ends up.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be setting the table for Trent and Statlander to be aligned, and probably with Callis. Like that could be where
could
this goes.
Could be not.
The Elite arrived earlier today, calling Edmonton a dump, and they pull up and they take Tony Khan's parking spot.
Yeah, which I think is fair. Tony's not going to show up. You know, it's not hardly I think a mean spirited move.
Well, in fairness, here at Rogers, I mean, they probably don't have TSN Plus, so they probably didn't see the angle, and we're assuming Tony Khan would be here, so they put a parking spot there for him. Mm-hmm. Jack Perry cuts a promo. This was last week after the attack on Omega and had a busted eye, and says Omega is not the hero they needed, and he's a coward like everyone else. The Elite in AEW, they don't need Omega. We will change the world without you.
So this was like an online only thing, and they've done a lot of online only things with Jack Perry and the Elite.
A lot of these with everyone, and there's some very good stuff that they put online that you just can't keep up with all of it.
Yeah, I'm so glad they decided to air this one on TV, because I thought Perry sounded really good in it. You know, like good emotion here. He's been sounding really good, especially in these like online exclusive types of promos. So I'm glad they included it.
And then it was time for Kenny Omega's announcement. So he's in his hospital bed and said the Elite was like family to him for the last 15 years. And they said that it's not personal, it's just business. Well, he also has business to take care of. And he has made a match for May the 25th, May the 26th at Double or Nothing. It is Anarchy in the Arena with the Elite taking on Team AEW. And the first two members, one of the greatest teams ever, FTR. And they will have two partners that will be revealed later tonight.
On a first come first serve basis, he said.
So just anyone could have. I mean,
well, I don't know.
So like Angelo Parker and Matt Menard, had they been right there at the gorilla position?
I was expecting Chris Daniels and Matt Sydal. You know, they're always waiting back there for something going on. But I guess.
How did you feel this was a promotion for Canada's healthcare system? I mean, this looked like a pretty dire setup for poor Kenny here.
Well, I don't know what you expect. I mean, how are hospitals supposed to look? You know, this looked like a typical.
I mean,
hospital.
This is like the most. This is the most liberal description of a bed. I mean, it looks like they just give him a propped up chair. This guy with diverticulitis that may have had a fatal blow to his kidney last week. And
listen,
just
free healthcare is exactly that. Okay, like I'm glad it's free. I'm glad I live here. But
this is realistic that if he was struck last week, he'd be waiting to be checked on a week later. So that part is realistic.
I have no complaints. I mean,
no,
I'm sure Kenny
either.
Doesn't either.
I'm going to get some crazy messaging me about the realities of healthcare. It's just a joke, everyone. It's just a joke.
He should be happy, that he found space. What do you think of Anarchy in the Arena, presumably as the headlining bout for Double or Nothing?
Yeah, that was my thought, is that this is going to be the main event of the show. I was more interested to see like who the partners are going to be, and having seen them now, I think this is going to be an incredible match. Certainly a really different style of match for Okada to be in, especially.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, we could reveal it now. It's Eddie Kingston and Brian Danielson who are going to be teaming up with FTR. Anarchy in the Arena. I mean, they've at this point managed to create this great sort of expectation for Anarchy in the Arena matches, because they always deliver to such a high standard. And with Kazuchika Okada in this one, I'm very curious to see how that turns out. Brian Danielson in this one, you know, he's been in them before, but like just the combination of talents, there's no way this can't be good.
Yeah, like you're going to get Danielson Okada spots in this match as well. Like there's Like, this should be spectacular. This feels like a big match. That quite frankly, this pay-per-view really did need this type of a match added to it, because Swerve and Cage and Ospreay, Roderick Strong, even like Mercedes' debut, like, those are nice additions, but you need something to carry the show. This is the match that is like, feels like the clear number one main event of the show.
Yeah.
So then Shivani brings out Serena Deeb, and she knows how everyone loves Toni Storm. I love her too. And I know there's a narrative out there that people don't think I can beat Toni Storm. Well, losing is not an option for me. And then she gets into her story about why she missed 15 months. They were the hardest months of my career. And the crowd is getting checked out here, so they start chanting, "Let's go, Oilers." And
yeah, most unfortunate. I think maybe because of these Oilers fans in their jerseys that are centered right in the middle of this shot, that might have kind of sparked it. Very unfortunate because of the timing of like where she was. Like, she was about to get into like this incredibly personal and heartfelt story about her comeback. I also don't completely blame Edmonton, because like you have to understand the fever that must be in the air ahead of this second round playoff game that was supposed to occur hours away from this moment. I think also the crowd didn't recognize what she was about to talk about. And the moment they did, they kind of changed their tone.
Yeah, I mean, the chanting did start before she got into the serious nature. And when she did, number one, they kind of leveled out because they could see it was a kind of serious topic. And more importantly as well, Serena Deeb got more animated as the promo continued, and it turned into a very good promo, and the audience responded as such. So she's explaining that she suffered three seizures last year, and the doctors couldn't explain what caused it, and what kept her going was the vision of winning the women's championship. And she does a very good speech here by the end, and it was like you kind of came out of this hole to cut a really good promo. And then Toni Storm's music hits, and they all just go nuts for Toni Storm. And it was just like she could not win in this promo segment, that being Serena Deeb. And Toni comes out and calls her a charity case and tells Serena to start giving a shit. And she will messed up here. She calls her a charity case, and then Serena tells Toni to start giving a shit. And Serena promises to fight for her life to become women's champion, and Toni responds that she does not give a single solitary shit what you've been through. And this is all getting a babyface response from Edmonton, and Toni goes to attack Serena, but Serena just drops her with one shot, and Toni is out cold from this one punch at the end. So, I mean, it was a really tough spot here for Serena Deeb. Number one was just a crowd that she had to kind of win back, and then lost them again when Toni came out, because this was a pretty strong reaction for Toni Storm. And it's a continuing problem that they have for, I would say, Serena Deeb is not even this, like, she's been a heel up until this point, and then all of a sudden she's shifted into this babyface role as well. Like, it is a bit jarring that we're going from here's sort of the, like, the badass shooter of the division, and now we're telling this sympathetic story with a character that by its very nature lends itself to audience participation in Timeless Toni Storm.
I think maybe more even important than like babyface and heel divisions, it's just even having some sort of establishing knowledge of Serena Deeb on a Dynamite prior to this, and she didn't really have any sort of presence on Dynamite prior to this. She did on Collision, but again, it's a fraction of the audience, and it's fine. But I think this was at least their attempt at laying some of the groundwork to introduce an audience to Serena Deeb, and maybe given how frequent these Toni Storm challenges are, these sort of month-long introductions and payoffs are kind of what maybe we can expect. I think we at least get a chance to see where Serena Deeb is at as a promo in front of a live audience, and I thought she sounded really good. I'm with you. I wish she could have had a bit more time, because she was just starting to get into that very kind of passionate state where I think I needed to hear a bit more. So maybe, hopefully, she gets that time later on, but I thought she sounded good.
Lexi Nair is with Orange, who's getting checked on by the trainer, and Rocky Romero comes in and says if he gets to beat Jay White tonight, they're going to get a trios title shot, which explained that one. But with a partner, with the partners of his choosing. So he said that you and me, maybe we could team up with Ishii, maybe Shibata, Or maybe we could patch things up with Trent. Orange was like, dude, do you even watch this show? No. He turns this offer down.
He's a very busy man, Rocky, I'm sure. I don't know what this was kind of meant to be, okay? Because, like...
The last we heard from Rocky Romero is he was going off on his own. He was moving on from this drama with the best friends, and he's going to focus on his career.
Yeah, and so why is he coming in here and teasing a possible reunion with Trent after, like, the angle we just saw? Like, why are they even flirting with that idea? You know, like, was it just to kind of create this reaction from Orange Cassidy of just, like, what the fuck are you talking about? This man just pile-drove me onto steps. By the way, on that spot, like, Trent almost lost his footing on the steps. It was, like, when he held Orange up in the pile driver, he almost, like, fell onto the next stair. Did he? No. Yeah, it was very scary. But anyway, like, I don't know what this was meant to be. Rocky ended up losing the match, so this wasn't even a possibility. So was it just a way to get this reaction out of Orange or create some doubt in the result? I'm not really certain.
Mariah May versus Harley Cameron. They mentioned that Harley Cameron has had two matches previously in AEW. Of her 22 total matches in her career. And May is attacking her with chops, and Saraya is ringside, and she rams May into the barricade and yells at Mariah May that she is a fake Brit. And then, throughout picture in picture, like, Saraya is yelling at people in the crowd, and then she gets the camera guy to put the camera on these guys in the front row who she calls creeps. This is a very odd portion of the match. This felt like Saraya was legitimately upset with these people. Like, this didn't feel like just like a heel tactic to just play with the crowd. I couldn't tell what was going on here, but it sounded like they said something to her.
Huh.
There was a sky high by May for a two count, and then May stops, eat the feet, lands a headbutt, and May hits a missile drop kick. Hip attack is attempted, but Saraya yanks Cameron out of the way, and May then hits Saraya with an elbow on the floor and wins with the Mayday in 9 minutes and 11 seconds. I can't say there was anything particularly special about this match, but I would say, like, Harley Cameron was fine for someone that like I really had no expectation for. Like, it was fine. I don't want to like oversell this. I continue to be impressed with Mariah May. I think she is like a really great, and she was here with somebody very inexperienced, and they had to go 9 minutes here, which I did not think they were going to, and go through a commercial, no less, as well. This was a lot longer than I expected it to be.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was interesting to continue to see her sometimes work as a heel and sometimes work as a babyface. I think she's looked good in both instances. And I agree. I thought Harley Cameron looked perfectly fine. Now, is she up to the standard that I expect of an AEW wrestler where in-ring quality, especially on a Dynamite, should be held to a much higher standard? No. But for like an occasional sort of like, you know, showcase win for a babyface, I thought she did perfectly fine here. And then we have a post-match angle here as well, don't we?
Saraya attacks May from behind, and they cut to the entrance where no one is coming out. So we go back to the ring, and then Mina Shirakawa's music plays and comes out, spinning back fist to Cameron, and then she goes to kiss Mariah May, but then she turns her cheek and grabs the champagne. So kind of left her hanging here.
Yeah. Well, so now this is like, you know, several weeks now, Mina Shirakawa coming in and making the save for Mariah May at times when Toni Storm is unavailable. So I guess like they are trying to hint at some sort of jealousy story where Mariah has to choose between the two. And I'm assuming this is all leading up to Forbidden Door. I think they could still do a bit of a better job of like really explaining like that direction, you know, like we haven't even had an interaction yet between Mina Shirakawa and Toni Storm introducing the jealousy. It's almost like Toni Storm has not like neither of them have really kind of shown it yet. And maybe they're just kind of waiting for it to ramp up, but we're getting like a lot of weeks of this now where I don't know if these sort of segments are really garnering any sort of reaction, because I think they haven't been clear enough about how the audience is supposed to feel about this.
Yeah, I mean, the audience was fairly cold for this post-match. Arcani Aura is with Pac, who looks like he's has
in
not
full
slept
gear.
Since the last time we saw him. Okay, yes. He's also in his gear. And they ask him about a Death Triangle reunion when the Bang Bang Gang walked by and said the Death Triangle is dead. And you lost to Okada, whereas Jay White knows how to beat Okada. Maybe you should take notes. And Jay White teases going for the Continental title. And He's got the titles wrapped around his gold bat here. So this was quite the interaction.
Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, seemed to be a tease of a future Trios interaction, right? Or at least...
Well, we would get more here with Pac and the guns. Malakai Black did a promo discussing Adam Copeland's hopes and dreams, but later he became aware of his own mortality and he traded in those hopes and dreams for a wife and children and created a facade for who he really was. And Adam had to be reminded who he really is. And it's Black's job to kill that facade and prove that Copeland is still vile and an evil son of a bitch. I must bring him to the brink of death so you can live again.
Mm.
Run.
It is very similar to Bray Wyatt Cena feud from WrestleMania 30, which we will be discussing tomorrow. Spooky Heel wants to unleash the dark side of the fan friendly babyface in order to prove some sort of point. Tale as old as time, isn't it? You know, I mean, I thought that at this point, like, this sort of feud needed a bit of like a good explainer of the story, and this provided that.
There was a vanity video produced by the EVPs for themselves, and they compliment themselves on this. Swerve comes out, and he's pissed because of Christian and Killswitch yanking one of his dreads out of his head. And he tells Christian, you know, I would have done the same thing. I'm not mad. And he says, I'm the Connor McDavid of AEW. Now, this is a smart guy. I mean,
yeah,
exactly where to aim his.
I had no idea who this was, but he's the Edmonton Oilers star.
He's pretty well known, yes. So, okay. Especially in Edmonton, yes. So he calls out Christian, and Christian comes out with the patriarchy, and Christian cannot wait to see the Canucks stomp the Oilers. So this to me was evidence that the man is not going to be on Collision on Saturday in Vancouver. Well, I was lying on Wednesday.
He could change his tone depending on the result of the match.
That actually would be funny. Yes.
Yeah.
He says he's decided he's going to take something from Swerve every week until he takes what he ultimately wants from him, referencing the title. And that Swerve is riding a wave, but that wave is going to crash at Double or Nothing. Swerve is not in his league and threatens to take the man's gold teeth when Swerve says, I didn't come alone. And in come his backup, Brian Cage, and the Gates of Agony. And they're standing in the ring. Swerve says, I'm going to beat your ass like Kendrick Lamar did to Drake. And it won't be the first time someone from the West Coast has taken down a fake father from Toronto.
Oof. Okay.
This is of the top wrestling references. We have quite the list of nominees this week. This had to be number one.
Well, by far. We had at least three, okay? We had CM Punk. We had
Kofi,
which I thought was probably the weakest.
Yes.
But this one was by far the most creative, and yeah, this was bars.
He says that when Christian is put in uncomfortable positions, you say, I quit. And then Christian looks at him and starts smiling when Brian Cage and the Gates of Agony jump Swerve. And they toss Swerve into a powerbomb by Brian. Military press him to the floor, and then the Gates of Agony step up onto the stairs, put Swerve through the desk. Swerve, man, picked some poor backup here. And that was our segment, which the Young Bucks gave this segment 4.5 stars to, telling Christian Cage they enjoyed doing business with him, and this could be the start of a fruitful relationship, as they laughed over this being their revenge for Swerve calling it a bitch move, what they did to Tony Khan.
Yeah, so it seems to continue this association between the Patriarchy and the Young Bucks, who the Bucks at this point just might be collecting all the heels in AEW on their side. We have some clarity, at least, you know, we have a defined line of where the Mogul Embassy sits. The Mogul Embassy perhaps is no more, although
minus Prince Nana, who was not part of the segment. And I guess you do have that hanging of where Prince Nana's allegiance is.
Yeah, they have the explainer, or at least he was attacked last week. Therefore, he wasn't here. I think it's great. It's good. You know, it sets Swerve up on his own as the lone wolf. And I think it hopefully opens the door for somebody in the Gates of Agony to take the step up. Like, you had Bishop, you know, Khan here say a few words to the camera. I don't think I've ever heard that man speak once, okay, the entire few years I've seen this guy on TV. So hopefully him or Toa Leona can maybe take a bit of a step up and become a bit more of a bigger personality without Swerve.
Yeah, he's He's the less recognizable Khan in the company. I don't know. I watch this for these guys. They hopefully they're not Giovanni Vinci'd.
No, yeah, that is a danger as well.
Like, are you guys sure you want to be parting ways at this point? Mm. Then there were highlights of the Manitoba Massacre.
Did you sense them flirting with the I quit stipulation as well?
I mean, he brought it up. It seemed more to be as sort of to get under Christian's skin. But I guess, yeah, they kind of introduced that.
Because I think the match needs something, you know, like it, on paper, it's not the most attractive match for a pay-per-view. I think an extra stipulation might help it.
They could go that direction. They did bring it up here. Aura is with Willow Nightingale, who also has a black eye from last week. So, I mean, man, a lot of wounded individuals from last week. She's ready for any challenge. The question is Mercedes ready? Because the last time, I was the one to walk out of that match. And I'm sorry you got hurt, but I'm on the run of my life. And you are the one that needs to be ready on May 26th because we are going to have the fight of our lives. And this is a really good promo from Willow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she continues to impress me, you know, and maybe the biggest benefit of having one of these championships in AEW is that she now gets a time to consistently show what she can do on the microphone and at the very least getting those reps in. But I think she's actually a bit impressing in the role.
Jay White and Rocky Romero, 8-minute match here, which Rocky Romero sold for like 70% of this match, as the announcers are saying. He's wrestled nearly a perfect match. I'm like, even in the context here of this being real, he has not been wrestling the perfect match here. He has been on defense for most of this. So White tries for the Blade Runner. Romero counters for a backslide. I will say this. The near falls that they did, Jay White waits for like just like half a second longer. And it made some of these like two counts have like a slight bit more drama to them. It was one thing. They did it several times in this match that was noticeable to me. There's a Shiranui by Romero and then kicks out and White hits what you can interpret as the Bloody Sunday, or you can interpret it as the paradigm shift as a potential direction that they're going here. But it was the second week in a row that Jay White did this and then hit the Blade Runner to win in 8 minutes and 7 seconds as the announcers lament that Rocky Romero, he wrestled nearly a perfect match, except he totally lost. And thus, we are not going to get a trios title match for Rocky Romero and friends. So the guns attack Romero, and that is when Pac comes out and gets involved here. So it would seem more likely that Pac is going to get some friends, namely Penta and maybe Rey Fénix, depending on if this guy is going to be cleared or not, because
he was pulled off of a House of Glory show this past weekend.
Yes, they had promoted this match, and then come the day of the show, they're like, oh, he's not cleared.
Hopefully that's just sort of a, I don't know, caution type of thing, and hopefully the guy didn't get injured on his first match back, which would just be so awful for Rey Fénix. Maybe the idea that they're teasing a possible Death Triangle reunion here should give you hope that Rey Fénix will be okay. But even if it's not teasing a Death Triangle match, but just a Pac versus Jay White match, I think that's a pretty attractive match for a pay-per-view.
Then we got a workout video with Samoa Joe, and he speaks about the fear that warriors have, the fear of not being good enough, the fear of meeting an opponent you cannot beat. Those are the qualities of a warrior, and they are my qualities. But I am not a warrior that fears. I am what these men fear in the first place. I mean, this guy should just have his own like 30 minutes every week. I mean,
oh, fantastic.
He's just these segments, like whether it's him like puffing on a cigar, looking like Kingpin, or doing calisthenics here with a medicine ball. I mean, this guy's such a terrific personality.
Oh, God, so great. Yeah, really well produced. I mean, I think just the footage of Joe training, I'm sure this is like just him doing his normal training, is just is captivating because he hits so heavy. I also noticed in the background they were playing like All Japan, old All Japan matches too on the TV screen. So that's, I'm sure, maybe what he likes to train to. It's even cooler, you know, seeing that.
It's probably on YouTube that he was watching it, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Jericho and Big Bill against Mo Jabari and Harlan Abbott, Alberta-based independent wrestlers. Abbott's been wrestling for like 20 years, so this was a television appearance for him. And Abbott like got a reaction when he got tagged in here. There were enough people that were familiar with him. And so Jericho is working early on, and then he tags in Bill, who just gets to get a showcase here. Boss Man slam, choke slams to both guys, and pins Abbott in two. He choke slams both and then tags in Jericho, who hits the Judas effect and gets the glory, pinning Abbott in 2:35. And Jericho gets on the mic. He says, "It's great to be back here in Calgary, Edmonton." And he corrects himself. And he actually did this in like a pretty good delivery in terms of it being purposeful, but doing it in such a way to try and make it feel like this was an honest to God mistake on his part, which is not the easiest thing to convey.
Oh, it was a very well done shot at Edmonton.
I thought the way he handled it was like very funny here, just very to well make done. It seem as though this was a mistake. And the crowd's on him like right away, "You fucked up." And he's giving his fake regret. He says, "When you travel the world, you make mistakes sometimes." And he wishes, "I wish I could be on Dynamite for 2 hours. I would do it if I could." And he puts over Big Bill. Thanks, Shibata.
I should have said three, then he would have gotten a lot of boos.
That would have been it. And he thanks Shibata. Their match got the highest rating on Cage Match last week.
And wow. So is that like the new way to attract heel heat these days, to brag about your Cage Match rating?
The Bucks used the star rating earlier after the face-to-face, and then we got Cage Match represented here.
Yeah. So. Like, is there anything more obnoxious than a wrestler bragging about their Cage Match rating?
That would probably be the peak of...
Maybe a promoter bragging about their Cage Match rating.
Yeah, yeah. So he thanks Hook and says, "Hook, take as much time as you need to recover." And then Shivani informs him, "Hook will be back here next Wednesday." And Jericho says, "That's great. We're going to celebrate next week." I thought Jericho had a pretty good segment here. I thought that his promo work here was pretty fun. This is still a character that I don't think many people are sold on. But I hardly think this is as detrimental as it kind of felt for me on the pay-per-view, where it was very split. But I think he is having a lot of fun with this character at this point.
I'm enjoying the new gimmick. Like, I'm at the point where I can flat out admit that I'm enjoying it, you know, and I think you're seeing a lot of fresh creativity from Chris Jericho in this one. This is like the most interested I think I've been in a Chris Jericho iteration in quite some time. It's a self-aware parody of so much of the audience's real critiques about him. Like, I feel he's successfully turned the corner on this go-away reaction. But then again, I'm not really somebody who was ever turned off as maybe some of the reaction that I've been seeing online. So I am curious to see, for a lot of those people, if they feel the same way about Jericho, or if these promos might have changed it. I think for Big Bill, you know, I'm most curious to see what this does for him, because I think you will be able to lay like real criticism on this if Big Bill just kind of comes out of this, the Jericho Ford vortex, not elevated whatsoever. He needs to be elevated coming out of this, you know. On the surface, being in a tag team again might feel like a linear move for him, but I think being tied to Jericho will assure a bigger platform, will probably assure a bit more airtime, hopefully more promo time than maybe his tag team with Ricky Starks. So we'll see about that.
And then the main event was Adam Copeland and Brody King, no DQ, for the TNT Championship. They mentioned this is Copeland's first match in Edmonton in 14 years. And King goes after the neck. He's trying to elbow him, and Copeland escapes a pile driver attempt and then gets the neck snapped on the rope. So King dominates through the picture-in-picture. And there's a running cross body as he seats Copeland against the barricade, but Copeland gets out of the way, so King crashes into the barricade. And Copeland uses the chair to DDT King on top of it, on the edge of the apron, and King emerges, and he is covered in blood from this DDT on the chair. And so Copeland breaks off the piece of the chair. He's trying to use it, applies the crossface, and puts the bar in Brody King's mouth and is pulling back. And then there's no rope breaks in this match, so King has to pull himself free of this submission. Copeland then sets up a table, and King is flipped off the turnbuckle, double boots, put both men down, and then a cannonball is hit by King. King blocks the spear, hits a pile driver, and they make their way onto the edge, where King is lifted up and takes a Death Valley driver, staggers up as Copeland spears him off the apron through the table on the floor. This was the Mick Foley WrestleMania spot, minus the fire, which we didn't need at Edmonton, and spears him again in the ring for Copeland to win and retain the championship.
Yeah, I thought this was a really excellent match. I think it's at this point where, like, it's worth reminding ourselves that Adam Copeland is a 50-year-old man who was at one point, many years ago, forced to retire due to spinal stenosis. So when you just kind of see the body of work he's already achieved in this AEW run, I mean, first of all, it was amazing to see him go back to the WWE and even for a few times a year having the matches that he was having. But in AEW, like, the standard of physicality is arguably a bit higher. And for him to wrestle at the frequency that he's wrestling, at this level of intensity, taking the bumps that he's been taking, delivering the quality of matches like he has, I think it really is amazing. And I don't know if we're giving him enough credit for that. So I just see this, and I see what's coming up for him. I just hope he's staying safe through it all. Like, there comes with, I think, this TNT title, maybe the expectation to do the Orange Cassidy and, like, defend it all the time. And I'm sure for Adam Copeland, too, like, there might be a bit of a desire in him to want to show to a more hardcore wrestling, like a diehard wrestling fan base, that he is capable of delivering this sort of frequency, this sort of quality, despite not having the indie cred, you know, that maybe a lot of AEW favorites might. I just hope he kind of takes care of himself, because he's going really hard, and in matches like this demand a lot from him. Brody King was outstanding here. The blood, if you're gonna bleed on TV, like, better make it look like this, man. Like, this definitely added a lot to the match and took it to another level.
This looked like they took a paintbrush and just went right over his head with it.
Yeah, I thought for a second it might have been fake just because of how, like, bright his blood is. So, but you see it dripping out. It definitely wasn't fake.
Yeah, this match went 18 minutes, 18 seconds with John Cena's one match recommendation from his report, if you want to go check that out as well.
John Cena, who also had to update the cage match ratings at the same time as Jericho mentioning that promo.
I mean, he's the man who probably tabulated Chris Jericho's cage match rating last week.
Maybe.
So King attacks afterwards, prompting Kyle O'Reilly to come out to make the save. And we'd get a follow-up with them. Let's just cover that now, because Lexi Nair is with the two of them backstage, and Copeland thanks Kyle, and Kyle immediately asks for a TNT title shot in his hometown this Saturday, and Copeland asks, is that why you came out to help me? Well played, and he gives them the title match. So that's happening on Collision on Saturday, Kyle O'Reilly in Vancouver against Adam Copeland.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. I mean, again,
they've got a 3-hour block. They could go as long as they want.
Yeah. Hopefully this one is a bit more technical and ground based. But I mean, knowing, you know, O'Reilly striking, this is probably going to be pretty intense, too. I mean, not to mention the fact that it's in his hometown. They're going to want to deliver something that's very memorable. To me, this is, like, at least personally, it feels like a good draw for a Collision.
Backstage, they interview Mercedes Moné, who says she is so close to returning to the ring. She thrives under pressure. She's going to be courtside at the Celtics game tomorrow, then throwing out the first pitch at the Red Sox game. And in her downtime, she's training and getting ready for Willow. And Willow took something from me that you can never replace: time. And said, I've been asking myself, will I be as good as I ever was? Damn right I will. I'm that bitch. And says that Willow has had the run of her career because of me. And there's an asterisk next to her. And Moné changes everything at Double or Nothing.
If this is
going to be the catchphrase, we do need to have, like, a uniform pronunciation for the last name.
Oh, the
Moné versus Moné, which we've kind of defaulted to.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll have to rely on the announcers. Yeah, I'm That Bitch is notable. Isn't it, to hear her say
maybe
that?
Maybe it was on the free agency list and they scooped it up.
Well, Jade wasn't going to pick it up, I guess. Like, she's kind of left it behind. So I guess Mercedes can use it now. Yeah. I mean, at this point, I think I have an expectation of, like, what a Mercedes promo is going to sound like. And I thought this was perfectly fine. Like, didn't tell us anything new, but just kind of reiterated, you know, what the story is. She's getting revenge for Willow injuring her. I'm almost looking at this as, like, just giving Mercedes reps to eventually maybe get to a level where she should be.
It's hopefully just going to be something she continues to improve on, because it's less the content for me and more so it's just the very robotic pacing that it just feels so mechanical. Like, I just feel like the wheels turning as she delivers, like, this dialogue. And I think it's just like a rhythm thing that she is so locked into that she needs to break from.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if they experiment with any of the pre-tape ideas with her. You know, like what we saw with Samoa Joe today. Like, think about like the great type of segments you could do with a Mercedes Moné. They should be following her when she's going to all these sports games, and you know,
they should absolutely be showing that stuff. Like, 100%. They talked about this with Swerve at the press conference. Like, that's stuff you should 100% be showing your talent as. Big figures in these, like, this is not your AAA baseball team. Like, you're talking the Celtics during the playoffs and the Red Sox, like
something like that, like a highlight video showcasing this is what Mercedes Moné has been doing this week is going to do way more for promoting her value and status as a superstar than an interview segment like this, unfortunately.
And then the Elite come out and they've contacted the network for an overrun. Okada wishes Omega to get well soon. And then Matt Jackson tells Tony Khan, you're the best boss ever. We hope you feel better. We just wish you got out of your own way. And we were never here to hurt AEW. We were here to make AEW a better place. And Khan got in their way. They had no choice but to give Tony Khan a TK driver and give an EVP trigger to an EVP in Kenny Omega. They accept the Anarchy in the Arena challenge and wish FTR good luck finding partners with the balls to face the Elite. So FTR comes out, and Dax Harwood, in the follow-up to his Bart Simpson shirt, comes out with a Chris Farley shirt that was pretty great. And they have found men with testicles. The first, Eddie Kingston, comes out, and this was a gigantic reaction that Eddie Kingston got, and is followed by the returning Brian Danielson, who has survived the Tiger Driver. And he is out. He is cleared, they note. And then, literally, you could not script this better. In the final 10 seconds, they state, Daniel Bryan is cleared, and he's wrestling on Saturday, and he's on Dynamite next week in Everett, Washington. And then they get into a fight with the Elite as we go off the air. So Danielson is back. He is wrestling on... We got a three-hour block on Saturday, and they announced nothing until these final 5 minutes. But you are getting two pretty big matches. Well, one big match in Adam Copeland, Kyle O'Reilly, and something involving Brian Danielson, but they did not announce who he is facing.
Right, yeah. It seems to be the philosophy they're sticking to, right? Maybe occasionally they break that and announce something for a Collision, but they seem
I feel bad for the people that DVR'd this and it cut off at 10, because you would have no idea what's happening on this three-hour block on Saturday night that you would have no reason to tune into without knowing what's on it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be any... Like, how are ticket sales, do you know, for Saturday?
I'd have to check with Vancouver, but it's like these Canadian shows, they've been fine. They've been slightly above like some of the US ones, but let me just look at Vancouver. The last update, this is probably higher now. It was around 6,000 at the last update that I saw from WrestleTix. Okay. So that's a good number for AEW. Like we were at over 4, which is fine for Edmonton. Six is good anywhere.
Right.
Mostly anywhere.
Yeah. Either these shows are so packed that they don't have time to do the rundown anymore, or they're happy enough with the result of just announcing it this way.
Well, there we have it. That was a lengthy edition of Dynamite by the end. I would not say this was like a home run show. I was with you. I really enjoyed the Copeland Brody King match. Like it's pretty much by and large, like we're no longer in this era of getting, you know, 5 to 6 matches on AEW, and 4 of them are these killer hot matches. Like that is like, you're looking for, maybe you're going to get 2 of those on a show. And we did not have 2 on this show, I don't think.
I thought like Orange and Trent was good, but maybe not to the level where like you have to watch it. I thought like Copeland and Brody kind of got there for me personally, just because of like
it was very good.
The intensity of the blood and everything. But like on paper is also another thing, and I don't think on paper this was like that attractive of a Dynamite, you know, like it especially in comparison, honestly, to like just even the feeling that you have of a WWE show these days. AEW needs that like kind of bigger, you know, hook, and I hate that I have to
that's next Wednesday.
Yeah, I know. But sorry, this show didn't necessarily have it. And I'm not saying show backstage footage on every single show, but like I think you need something that's a little bit more, that feels that much more of a bigger event, you know?
Well, let's go to a few pieces of feedback. And if you have any super chats, you can get them in before we say farewell. But
yeah, we got one here from Jake from the Windy City. Jake says, got JR's new book shipped to my place today, and I'm enjoying it so far. More AEW stories, too. Just wondering, John, if you'll check it out as well.
So this book was originally scheduled to come out just before WrestleMania, and they pushed it back to this week. So I actually got a copy of this like months ago and read it as well. I mean, it's a fun book in that the concept is he's taking 50 of his famous calls, and each call comes with a story attached to it, and it's 50 years of calls. So it's not quite a biography like his previous two books. It's a different format to it. But I did like it. It's a really quick read and just covers like everything from like Mid-South through Jim Crockett Promotions to WWF, all the different runs there. And then plenty of AEW stories too, which is kind of an update because his last book, I think it ends right as AEW is starting. So that stuff is fresh as well. But it's a book worth checking out if you enjoy like Jim Ross's stories. He has like plenty of like it covers like just so much different history attached to it.
Thank you for that $5 super chat, Jake.
Mark writes in, a great crowd really makes all the difference. On paper, this episode didn't seem like anything to write home about ahead of time, but the Edmonton Crown brought it and made 2 hours fly by. Copeland and Brody was a terrific bloody brawl. I've really enjoyed seeing Copeland in the new scenery that AEW has provided him. We're several weeks into it, and I'm thoroughly enjoying the building towards an all-out AEW civil war, seeing who gives their loyalty to the elite and who stands by Kenny and the company. On that note, whenever it is, Hangman will definitely play a major role. Does he fully embrace his dark side and run with the elite, or does he put past differences aside and stand next to Swerve? Thanks for everything. Well, thank you, Mark.
Yeah, that's an interesting X factor that they've kind of made no hint towards. That maybe we could expect to show up either at Double or Nothing or maybe in the time beyond. Doesn't it make all the sense in the world for him to feud against Swerve and join the elite?
It would. Yeah, I think if you were to do a temporary alliance with them, you would just be waiting for the turn. And that's a big match for them to go back to at some point.
And we, you know, let's remember, like, we usually have the combo of Anarchy in the Arena with Blood and Guts not long after that as well. And maybe that's when they'll expand to more of a 5-on-5. Hey, let's go to, lastly, Tanise from Georgia, who says, I thought the match and angle with Orange Cassidy and Trent was well done. Additionally, I'm intrigued by a possible Orange Cassidy and Callis pairing. Mariah did an excellent job carrying Harley. Willow is a natural on the mic and is outshining Monet. The Embassy turning on Swerve was effective, and it'll be nice watching him stand on his own. Jericho's disingenuous babyface persona is starting to win me over, and Cope had his best outing with Brody. Lastly, I love Okada for the little things he does perfectly. Overall, I think Anarchy in the Arena will be incredible. Very good episode of Dynamite. I agree that Okada, like, he only gets like one line on almost every episode, but he makes the most out of every single word that he has to say, you know, and he's just been, I've been so enjoying the charisma that he's been showing, just even delivering like one line a week.
The presence is very strong with him. Like, it totally, you know, he's had no issue with like the language barrier of like when he has to speak. It's like they're not giving him 5 minutes of dialogue. It's like it's short and to the point. And it's just another example of like, you know, someone whose first language is not English. It does not have to be a giant handicap. Not everyone is going to have that presence and charisma, but he does. And it's been pretty seamless transition into AEW for Okada. Like, there has been no transition process. Like, he has felt like a big guy since he's come in, and he's maintained that. Thank you to everyone tuning in tonight. Rewind Away is coming out Thursday, a big show going through WrestleMania 30. We're going to go through the show, but as always, we also go through a lot of the news items from that week in history, and then we will welcome on Mahmoud El-Mardi, who is the Espresso executive producer. He'll share some of his thoughts on the show and go through the trivia gauntlet of 2014. So all of that is coming your way. Lots of news and notes from that. And a WrestleMania that Wei and I were in attendance for 10 years ago in New Orleans, Louisiana.
It's a fun chat. It's a lengthy chat, but it's one with a lot of interesting discussion concerning the streak, Bryan Danielson, Bray Wyatt, John Cena, and a whole lot more. So
the reality era.
We'll see if that takes off over the next 10 years beyond that. Special shout out, of course, again to our sponsors, nordvpn.com/postwrestling, to get your deal. And just in time for Double or Nothing, maybe subscribe to AEW Plus and maybe find some cheaper pricing for that pay-per-view too. And also eBay Motors.
The great eBay Motors, taking over the world one motor at a time. And also today, I did do an audio news update for our Double Double and Espresso viewers. So if you want to have some... Ric Flair audio in your ears from his altercation. That is involved in the audio news update today, as well as all the latest news going on. And again, Pollock and Thurston live Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern time. We'll go through the whole TKO earnings call, all that and more coming your way. Check out postwrestling.com. And that is it for Rewind to Dynamite.